are listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
You're listening to Jack Marino, Warrior Filmmaker, right here on LA Talk Radio.
This is Jack Marino, ladies and gentlemen, your host of the Warrior Filmmaker Show here in the heart of Hollywood. I'm broadcasting to you tonight live somewhere high in the Hollywood Hills, and not too far from that famous Hollywood sign. From my dimly lit, smoke-filled studio, I can see the vast expanse of the city of Los Angeles, with its millions upon millions of lights twinkling in the night sky. And make no mistake, each one of those lights comes with its very own story. In the dark canyon far below the studio is the former estate of legendary movie actor Errol Flynn. And that's one great Hollywood story that never ends. Hear about today's Hollywood, that nice little neighborhood they have bad habits in, where the streets are dark with something more than night, where dead men are heavier than broken hearts, and this town is full of both. A place where able, talented, idealistic dreamers all vying for success, while others with absolutely no morals and the artistic integrity of a slot machine are all tightly packed together in a town with the personality of a paper cup. Learn about real independent filmmakers and how some, because of politics, are treated like flies buzzing around a screen door on a hot summer night. Listen to my guests with their endless tales about the golden age of Hollywood, where men were men and women were glamorous, a time when style meant class and doing the right thing was a way of life and virtue was its own reward. Hear about the dream factories, the stars, the films, the politics, all the wannabes, the has-beens, the dreamers, and the drunkards, all seeking glory and immortality. For this is Hollywood. This is the only place in the world that has the stuff that dreams are made of.
Well, good evening, Los Angeles. This is Jack Marino. I'm back here on LA Talk Radio for another show of Old Hollywood. I have a very special guest tonight, and I want to introduce him. He's been acting since 1944 as a contract player at Warner Brothers, and his name is Richard Erdman, and he's been around making lots of great films, knew a lot of great people, and I want to welcome Richard to the show tonight. Richard?
Jack, hello. Good to be here.
That's great. I happened to read that review on the internet by that Terry Keith was the website.
Yeah, right.
John Zellway, I think. And he was a great, great article. It was a great picture of you too on it, by the way.
Was there? I didn't see it.
Oh, okay. And you were mostly talking about your experience working on The Men with Marlon Brando.
Yeah.
And all those days. Yeah. But I want to get into even before that.
Okay.
And talk about when you grew up in Oklahoma.
Right.
And I guess your mom wanted you to be an actor.
Well, she got us out of the panhandle. That's in the upper part of Oklahoma when I was a little kid.
Right.
And because it was a dusty, awful place.
Right.
And we started west and we got as far as Colorado Springs. Right. And she decided that that was where I should grow up. And she was right. It was a wonderful place. In those days, a little 33,000 town, it's now almost a quarter of a million, I think.
Yeah.
But it's there at the foot of Pikes Peak, and it was beautiful, great place, wonderful schools.
Right.
And while I was there in my first year of high school, I had done a review, which I wrote and directed, and there was a man who was the drama coach there named Newton Winburn, who was a very wonderful, perceptive, helpful teacher. Anyhow, he told my mother that she should bring me to Hollywood, and so she did.
That's great.
And we came out here, and he said, put him in Hollywood High School and let him do something there, and he'll get a contract. And that's exactly what happened.
Wow.
Yeah.
At that age, now who were your favorite stars in those days? Who'd you really?
I really think there were three. Chaplin was certainly one of them. Let's see, who else was there? I'm trying to remember in those days because of your affinities change. I'll think of the others, but he was my number one favorite. Oddly enough, I liked Errol Flynn a lot. I had no idea I was going to be working with him.
Yeah, that's
eventually I did. But anyhow, Mickey Rooney.
Right.
Yeah, and I guess those were the two that I was most impressed
and
with.
And it said, I read in your bio that you did some vaudeville.
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
That was out of Colorado Springs.
Yeah, that must have been...
It was the dying days of vaudeville. I did a little show for North Junior High School down at the Chief Theater in Colorado Springs. And it got a lot of attention. And an old fellow named Charlie Martin, who was a vaudevillian, they had vaudeville there on Wednesday and Saturday afternoon.
Right.
And Charlie happened to see me and asked me to come along and be his straight boy. He played the violin and did jokes, and I set him up. And he said, I want you to understand, you don't get laughs, I get laughs. Is that understood? And I said, sure. Well, after 3 weeks, it's kind of hard not getting laughs. And
right.
I got one, and he knocked me in the pit.
Wow.
he was pretty serious about that, and I learned.
Yeah, Cagney, I read an interview with Jimmy Cagney. He was talking to Travolta.
Yeah.
And Travolta was complaining about how tough movies were, and he says, kid, movies are easy. Vaudeville is tough.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's right. Cagney, of course, was probably my favorite actor.
No, Cagney was great. Yeah. So by the time you arrived in Hollywood,
yeah,
and you got a contract with Warner Brothers, that was around 1943, 44?
That's right, 43.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you were a young kid then.
Yeah, I was 17.
Yeah, on the lot. That must have been an incredible time.
Oh, well, it was amazing.
Yeah.
It was, I was privileged. Of course, it was, the war happened, and they were signing anything that was male that could walk.
Right.
Because everybody was getting drafted.
Right.
And I got signed, and 2 weeks after I got signed, I got called up by the draft board. And as it turned out, I went down to March Field for 3 days, and they sent me home. And I said, "Why? What's happened?" And they said, "You didn't tell us, or we didn't notice. I'd had a bike accident delivering newspapers, and some nut in the middle of the night opened his car door, and I hit it, and went over the top and landed on my head.
Right.
And I lost my sense of smell.
Oh, wow.
And they said, you're a menace to anybody in the Air Force, which is where I joined, with no sense of smell, because you're not aware of things. And anyhow, they sent me home.
Wow.
And I went back to Warner Brothers, and I was there for 4 years.
Wow. And you got to one of your first roles, this uncredited roles, was Mr. Skeffington.
That's right.
And
that's right.
I got to know Vince Sherman the last part of his life.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. Vince was a great guy.
Yeah.
And he was very proud of that film, too.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember you played the
messenger boy.
Messenger boy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember that scene.
Yeah. I had a line. My first line was to Claude Rains, I think. I said, telegram from the War Department.
Right.
Oh, whoops. For Mrs. Fanny Skeffington.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
That was
He did some great films, Vince. And,
yeah.
Yeah, then you went on to, I think it was another film. Oh, when you were on the lot, did you ever get a chance to see Bogart and Sidney Greenstreet?
Oh, Green Street I saw quite a lot in the green room, which is where we had lunch all the time.
Yeah.
And he was a very affable fellow and very, very nice, considerate, helped younger people quite a lot. And Bogart, I didn't really ever get to know Bogey. I did a picture with him later on called The Desperate Hours.
Oh, yeah.
With he and Freddie March, which was directed by William Wyler.
Right.
And I had one long short scene, rather, with Bogey in that. And, of course, he was an incredible character. He was. I think he gets better every year.
Yeah.
I really do. Every time I see him, I think, Jesus, look at him. Man.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. Yeah, he's just a great actor.
Yes, he was.
But when you were 17, 18 years old there, and these older actors that had been on the lot for 10, 12 years, were they friendly to you guys, the young kids?
Oh, yeah. We were all part of the same club.
Yeah.
And no, there wasn't any... I didn't really conflict with any of the older folks. and there weren't that many young men under contract.
Right.
So I had kind of a clear field there. It was they had classes of all kinds, so I could make up for what I lacked, a certain amount of experience, singing, dancing, boxing. Mushy Callahan, light heavyweight champion of the world, taught me boxing.
Yeah, I knew Mushy.
Yeah, did you?
Yeah, my grandfather knew him. When I came out here in 78, he told me to look up Mushy Callahan, A.B. Bain, Georgie Levine, Jimmy McLaren. And I got to meet Mike Mazurki and Kid Chisel at the Cauliflower Alley Club. So.
Sure.
Yeah, they had some great stories, those guys.
Oh, yeah. Well, Mushy taught everybody on the lot boxing. He taught Flynn, of course,
and Cagney. Cagney was a little scrapper, though. I think he was. He was a street fighter.
Yes, he was, and the gentlest man in the world. And he was. Shortly after he left Warner's, he produced his own movies.
Right.
And one of them was based on William Sorian's play, The Time of Your Life.
Right.
And I had a very good part in that, and we spent 14 weeks together on one set.
Wow.
And because it was a bar, and the whole thing took place in the bar.
Yeah.
And so we got to know one another very well. But he was one wonderful person.
Yeah, that's what they say.
Gentle and kind. There was a director of that picture who I did not particularly get along with. He certainly didn't like me. And I spent most of my time in the picture playing a slot machine. And you know, after 10 or 12 weeks, you get pretty frisky.
Yeah.
And looking for things to do. Finally, came the time for my big scene. And the director said, "Okay, Erdman, let's see it." And I thought, it's a little hostile there. So I had my scene. I hit the slot machine, made the jackpot, and then I had quite a considerable speech, and then I exited with a flourish. And I did it, and there was a pause, and the director said, "That's it?" And I said, "Oh, yeah." He said, "Lunch." I thought, uh-oh. So I went out to lunch, and Cagney was aware, and he hustled along behind me, and he said, "Got a problem?" And I said, "Yeah, I think so." And I said, "I don't quite know what to do. I'm not going to take a lot of shit, I'm telling you." And he said, no. He said, "You shouldn't, no." And anyhow, he bought me lunch, and we went back. And we did the scene. And we did it a second time. And a third time, which was a beauty.
Right.
I thought it was a beauty. And the director said, "One more." And anyhow, he printed take 3 and take 17. Anyhow, after the picture was all over, I ran into Cagney, another picture he was making. And he spotted me and came over and he said, "We use scene 3. It's a winner." And Life magazine called it the funniest scene of the year, as a matter of fact, which
was
a big thing in those days.
Yeah, that's
great.
Big
thing for me. Yeah, yeah. But he was very proud of that. He said, "Helped us sell the movie."
Yeah, they said he was really good to work with, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, he knew what he was doing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And then, in around 45, you worked on Objective Burma.
Yeah.
Private Nebraska.
That's right.
You'd rather have a hamburger than medals.
That's right.
Yeah.
That was with Mr. Flynn.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there are all kinds of things one reads here. I know that we were on that very, very miserable shoot for about 12 weeks, shooting up on the hill above Warner Brothers in the middle of the summertime. It was very, very unpleasant, very hot. And Flynn was a soldier about the whole thing. And the director, that particular director was a man named Raoul Walsh.
Right.
And Raoul was notable because he had one eye. He had a patch he wore. He rolled his own cigarettes and he sat in a high chair. And the only thing he ever said to actors were one of two things: "Roll 'em, boys, and put a lot of life in it." Or, "Nice and easy now." And he knew when to say them, as it turned out. And anyhow, he did that all the time. And Flynn was valiant. And then we had a problem. How did that start? We were on that hill. Oh, yeah. They sent us, it was during the war, and so the lunches that they brought up there were lousy.
Right.
But we didn't expect much. But one morning, they wound up with powdered eggs and canned stewed tomatoes. That was it.
Right.
And it was so lousy and awful. Flynn took one look, and he got on the phone. He called Warner, and he said, "You know, this lunch is not acceptable. If there's a decent lunch up here, I'll work. Otherwise, I'm going home today."
Right.
And we waited and waited. And Frank Tang was a Chinese actor who had a restaurant called Tang's downtown. And he came over and he said, "Mr. Flynn, you want some lunch?" And Flynn said, "What do you mean?" He said, "30 minutes. And 30 minutes later, we had chow mein and all this wonderful stuff from Tang's downtown.
That's great. That's great.
And he said, "Anytime you want anything," and Flynn said, "Thanks." And he said, "You're welcome."
What'd you think of actors working with Anthony Caruso, George Tobias?
Oh, wonderful people.
Yeah.
Wonderful people. George, of course, this big toughy from New York.
Yeah.
You know, his passion was Bach.
Oh.
He knew Bach's music up and down the walls.
Yeah.
And he loved it. He could whistle anything Bach wrote. He
would. Wow.
That's so, you know, incredible from a person like him.
Yeah, yeah.
And Tony Caruso was a wonderful person.
Yeah, I met them both in the late 70s. I met Tony in the 80s because he's good friends with Robert Mitchum.
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
And I the day Mitchum got a star on the Walk of Fame, I was there.
Oh, yeah.
And I got to talk. Tony and I walked back to his car. We were talking.
Yeah.
But I got to meet George Tobias at the Cauliflower Alley Club, and he had long, long hair.
No kidding.
Yeah. And he was sort of bald on the top, but he
had
I mean, it didn't look like him at all. Yeah. But then when you saw him, you said, "Oh, that's George Tobias." So,
yeah.
I don't know if he was doing any television at the time. You know.
No, not yet.
Yeah. Now you in the around 1950s? You started. You did a movie called Nobody Lives Forever. You played the bellboy. You started getting into these film noir movies.
That Nobody Lives Forever. Yeah, that was with John Garfield.
Right.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just had a little bit in that, but I was still in a contract.
Yeah.
And he was a wonderful character. John Garfield's another wonderful man.
Yeah. What about now? You played that, they say one of your supposedly adult roles, you went from being a juvenile player to adult. You played in Cry Danger.
Yeah.
And you played the alcoholic DeLong.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Written by a very colorful person named Bill Bowers. You've probably heard about Bill. He's a legend around town.
Yeah.
A drunk and one of the funniest men in the world. Well, he wrote it. I remember I went in to meet Powell. It was Powell's movie, actually, Dick Powell. And he had just made a movie called... What was that comeback movie he made when he played the first Dick?
The Dick Powell?
Yeah.
Oh, jeez.
I'll think of it. But anyhow, I went in, and here was Dick Powell, and he said, "Dick," he said, "come along with me," and we went over to a lousy little room, a little smaller than this one, with a typewriter on a desk and some paper, and two bottles of bourbon.
Yeah, that's
and that was Bowers, and Bowers was there, and he looked at me, and he looked at me, he said, "You're going to play this part?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "It's the best part in the movie, you know that?" And I said, "Yeah," and so Powell said, "How can we help you?" Well, pretty nice thing to say. And I said, "Just tell Mr. Bowers to keep writing those words." And halfway through the movie, we heard this story. Bowers was in the Air Force, I believe it was, for about 10 days. And he went down to March Field. And then he had to commute back and forth to Los Angeles. And he passed these signs that Forest Lawn had put up in those days.
Right.
Forest Lawn would start advertising. And they had a slogan, which bothered Dick, bothered Bill. The slogan was, "Don't let seepage spoil your loved ones." Well, questionable taste. Yeah. Anyhow, it bothered Bowers. And Bowers finally one day got on the phone. And he called Forest Lawn.
Right.
And they said, "Forest Lawn?" And Bill said, "My name's Bowers." He said, "I want to talk to somebody there." And they said, "How old are you, Mr. Bowers?" And he said, "I'm 31. They said, "Well, that's showing remarkable foresight. What can we do for you?" And he said, "I'm interested in a plot." And they said, "Oh, you want a plot? Very, 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 very interesting." He said, "Yes." And then, "I want it under that tree there by the main entrance." And they said, "Well, we can't do that. That belongs to somebody that's been paid for." Bill said, "Well, it doesn't matter that much. What I really want is lots and lots of seepage."
Right.
Well, There was a long pause. And the guy said, well, Mr. Bowers, we pride ourselves on not having seepage. And what else can we do? He said, no. I said, I need lots of seepage. I can manage it. I know what I can do. He said, I've got a friend. I can be cremated. That's what I can do. And then they can put me in a can. The guy's a glider pilot. He can go over the cemetery, and he can just spray my ashes that way. And there was a long pause. And this nice old man from Forest Lawn said, you do that, and we'll sue you for every nickel you got. Anyhow, Bowers was one of a kind.
Oh, those old writers were just phenomenal.
Oh.
You know, there was one character you played. It was a great name, and I wrote it down here, and I just couldn't think of the character. And when I read it about it, and it's like they had some great names for characters in those days.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
That Peter Fairfield?
It could be. I mean, it's I got all these names here. I can't even read my own writing.
Right.
But let's get on to you got the job in The Men with Marlon Brando.
Yeah.
And you and Jack Webb and Marlon went down to the VA hospital for a couple of days. And
Marlon and I did. Jack wasn't in on that particular venture. Okay. But no, Marlon went out first, and then I heard he was out there. I hadn't met him.
Yeah.
He was Marlon, from the word go, and he wanted to be with the guys out there. They were all paraplegics. And he moved in, and I moved out, and I was there for 3 nights. And we slept in beds and used wheelchairs the way the guys did. And, of course, that very famous incident when we went out on a Saturday night to the pump room. Do you remember that?
I don't.
One of the guys, Pat Grissom, was a very colorful paraplegic. And he said, okay, you guys think you're good. Why don't you go over to the pump room with us tonight? We're all going to go, and you're going to go in your chair, and you're going to be one of us, okay? And so we did. And we wheeled ourselves in, got a table, and had some drinks. And we're sitting there, and all of a sudden this woman came over from the bar. And she looked at us, and she said, you boys are paraplegics, aren't you? And nobody said anything. She said, it means you can't walk, right? And Brando said, that's right, lady, leave us alone. Just leave us alone. And he was being very paraplegic. And she said, no. She said, you could walk if you really wanted to. And Brando said, lady, leave us alone. Just go away. And she said, don't you want to walk? And he said, of course, but just leave me alone. She said, just envision the almighty power of God. And Brando looked at her and he said, what? And she said, imagine all the strength of God seeping through your legs up into your body. You can stand up from that chair right now. Brando said, I can't do that, lady. And she said, you can if you try. You just try. The envision. And so gradually, Mar Brando said, I think I can do it. And I think, and he started, and he rose, and he got up. He almost was on his feet, and he fell back in the chair, and he whimpered, and he said, look what you've done to me. Well, it was the goddamnest performance you've ever seen in your life. And the woman said, don't stop. You can do it. You can do it. And he said, no. She said, yes, try again. And so here Brando now works himself up. Oh, sweats and struggles and pulls himself up out of his chair. Suddenly ran out in the middle of the room, did a little tap dance, and ran out of the bar. Well, that woman thought she'd cured him, of course. Anyhow, that was a marvelous joke.
Yeah, that's but they said Brando was a guy that would, pull stuff like that. He was just a practical joker.
He was an original.
Yeah, yeah. We're going to take a quick little break, Richard, and we'll be right back, and I want to talk about Starlock 17.
Oh.
After a lifetime of drifting, the 32-year-old Flynn decided to build a home, and he wouldn't place it in Beverly Hills or Bel Air like other stars. Errol Flynn wanted a hideaway and bought 11.5 acres of ravine off a dangerous, dusty mountaintop road called Mulholland Drive. Find out all about Errol Flynn and the house he built. Mulholland Farm. In Errol Flynn Slept Here, the Flynns, the Hamblins, Rick Nelson, and the most notorious house in Hollywood. From Good Night Books. Order your copy today at www.paladincalm.com.
Forgotten Heroes, the independent film that Hollywood refused to distribute.
They were asked to risk their lives in order to save their enemy.
The producers of Forgotten Heroes are donating 25% of all sales to the American Veterans Disabled for Life Memorial Fund.
We need someone to go in there and bring them out.
From first-time director Jack Marino, the home run for America's Vietnam veteran.
They are Forgotten Heroes.
Buy the DVD now at ForgottenHeroesTheMovie.com. That's ForgottenHeroesTheMovie.com.
NewsNetUSA.com. This site has everything for the person seeking to be informed. Numerous news feeds from around the nation and the globe. NewsNetUSA.com has national and world news feeds, government and financial news feeds, dedicated news on the climate wars, blogs, original political cartoons, video and audio feeds, and of course, the NewsNetUSA commentary team. NewsNetUSA.com. Get your knowledge on.
You're listening to the Warrior Filmmakers Show with Jack Marino, LA Talk Radio.
Wow, we're all coming back here. Okay. So, Richard, so I want to get back to, it's 1951 now.
Yeah. That's only 58 years ago.
I know. I know.
Huh? We both know.
I was born in 52, so.
I'm not even going to talk about it. Were you born in 52? You're a kid.
52, yeah.
Oh, good for you.
As A.B. Bain would say to me, you're a puppy. you made a film called Blue Gardenia, and I was watching some of it last night.
Really?
Yeah, on YouTube.
Yeah.
And you worked with some nice-looking gals there, Ann Baxter and Ann Southern. I mean,
yeah, nice pretty good actresses, too.
Yeah, both. And what was it like working with Richard Conte?
Oh, Conte and I got along fine.
Yeah.
He was a tough fellow. He was obsessed with Cagney because he knew I'd worked with Cagney, and we'd go to lunch, and all he'd ever ask about was Cagney.
Yeah.
Because he wanted to be a Cagney. Well, yeah. He wasn't quite a Cagney, but he was very good in his own way. But we got along very well.
Yeah, he's my dad's favorite actor. My dad
really
always liked Richard Conte.
Yeah, well, he was good.
And so we come to Stalag 17. You play Hoffy, the barracks chief.
Yeah.
And
oh boy,
that must have been an incredible.
It started out funny. My agent was a marvelous character named Ingo Preminger.
Right.
Ingo is the brother of Otto, and Ingo had a great style. He was very tall, very homely man, but immaculate, and he was funny. If I was up for a part and I got it, why, he'd call me and he'd say, "Hello, Dick Ingo, we are rich." That's if I got the part.
Yeah,
if I didn't get the part, he'd say, "Dick Ingo, they are mules." Anyhow, Ingo took me in, being a Viennese, and Billy Wilder was actually Polish, but he took me in to meet Billy Wilder, who was, of course, right at the peak of his career at that point. And Wilder looked at me, and he said, "All right," he said, "Edmund, yeah, you can play this part," he said, "but you promised me one thing, no laughs." I said, "What?" And he said, "No laughs. This part is it's the spine of this movie. Everybody else gets laughed. You do what you do."
Right.
I said, "Okay, fine. Oh, yes, sir." Well, about the fourth week of the picture, I don't know, suddenly we're in the middle of a take, and I had been a very, very good boy, and suddenly Wilder said, "Cut. We shoot it again. Erdman got a titter." He wouldn't go for it. But it was quite an experience because we shot the whole thing on that one set,
right,
except the one outside scene in the beginning.
Where was that location?
Out in Encino.
Okay.
In Calabasas, actually.
Calabasas.
It was a dump in that time. There was nobody out there.
Yeah.
And then the set, of course, the big set was on Paramount.
Okay. The interiors, the barracks were all...
That was all at Paramount.
Okay.
Yeah.
And because all the stuff outside, the camp and That was all up there by.
That was out in Calabasas.
Was that near the Warner Ranch or?
No, it was out. Where was it? You know where Calabasas is?
Oh yeah,
yeah. Yeah, it's right there in the middle of Calabasas, okay. Actually.
Yeah, I got a friend who's doing a location book then and now.
Yeah.
And he's matching up.
It's yeah, yeah.
Phenomenal.
I'll bet.
Some of the stuff, you can see the movies in them, you know.
I'll bet.
And so what was it like working with Robert Strauss?
Strauss and Lemberg, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, of course, they had done the play.
Yeah.
And they were playing the parts they knew very, very well. And they hated each other, of course.
Really?
Oh, yeah. They really did not like each other. And Strauss, of course, was a clown. And a very funny man.
Yeah.
And Harvey was a surgeon. I mean, he knew all the little intricacies and all the little jokes, and he was a very, very, very good straight man.
Yeah.
But when it works that way, Strauss got most of the laughs and
right.
bugged the hell out of yeah. Lembeck, of course. And it reached a point where there was a scene where they danced together.
Right.
And it got to be so bad that Wilder had to cut because neither of them would turn so the other one could be seen by the camera. They cover one another. And Wilder said, we take 15 minutes. And we broke and we all went and had a cup of coffee and came back and it was over. And he talked to them. But the whole thing was, you know, it was an all-male cast.
Right.
And Wilder decided about a week into the shoot that he would treat us once a week by bringing in one of his leading ladies.
Right.
And so I think Thursday afternoon we had somebody, Barbara Stanwyck and Jean Arthur came down from Carmel.
Oh, wow.
And Dietrich came over.
Ooh.
Yeah. And all the other girls looked great. Dietrich, we wanted to take to bed.
Yeah, yeah, I bet.
Dietrich was such a great character. As a joke, they had Wilder set this up for the executives. They filmed it. And there's a knock on the door of the barracks, and I opened the door, and there's Dietrich standing. And she said, "Are you Huffy?" And I said, "I'm Huffy." She'd come to me. And she threw her arms around me and gave me a great big kiss.
Wow.
And we broke out of that. And Wilder said, "Cut." And they sent it through as part of the dailies. And, of course, the guys, they thought, "We can't have this in the movie." But anyhow, it was a joy from the beginning to the end. There was never any problem with anybody.
Right.
Except with Harvey and Bob. And eventually they resolved that.
Yeah. Well, that's
but
good.
Wilder, what are you going to do? He was one of the wittiest men that I've ever met.
Right.
And a wonderful human being on top of that.
Yeah.
And tough as nails on top of that.
Oh, so good. Well, that's a good director.
He had it.
Because he had some really tough actors. I mean, as far as big talent, William Holden.
You bet.
And then
we didn't know. Holden, of course, was very well behaved on that. Nobody knew he was going home being drunk every night.
Wow.
He kept a secret. He really did.
Wow.
Nobody knew.
Wow.
Until much, much later when a lady friend admitted that was what was happening.
Yeah.
But he was a great gentleman and a very fine actor.
Yeah. What about Jay Lawrence? He played...
Jay, yeah.
Yeah.
And Jay was... he was fine. He had a brother.
Larry Storch.
Larry Storch, yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
Who I met later.
Yeah.
And Jay was a kick. He did impressions of people.
Jay was incredible.
Good. Yeah.
I love that whole, when he comes in, he does Cagney.
Yeah.
He does Ronald Coleman.
Yeah,
that's
right.
That's just great stuff.
Yeah.
And who else was in that? I like the guy with he gets the letter from the wife.
Oh, yeah.
I believe her. I believe
that was Straczynski.
Yeah.
He was one of the authors of it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Ed Straczynski. I believe it. Yeah. I believe it.
No, it was a good film, and the ending was great when they, you know, they discover it was...
It was Peter Graves.
Price, yeah, Peter Graves. Price, yeah. I couldn't think of his name.
They had another ending Billy was going to shoot, and they at the last, I'd hoped they would. It was supposed to all... running through the woods, escaping from the Starlog.
Oh, wow.
Which would have been kind of wonderful. And then the titles would come over as we came out.
Yeah, yeah.
But he decided it was grandstanding, and he didn't want to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
So he left it the way it was, which is fine.
Well, I like how Holden leaves. He says, if any of you guys see me in the street...
We never met.
Yeah. And then he gets up and comes out and waves again.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
That was good. And there was somebody else in that show, too, that was...
Siggy Ruman?
Yeah, Ruman, yeah.
Great character actor.
Yeah, he was great.
He came down from Fallbrook. He has a farm down there.
Really?
And he came in and, oh, he's a big, very large actor.
Yeah.
Boy, he entered that. I'll never forget. It's so big, I thought, it's not going to play. It's, yeah, it's too big, Ziggy. But it wasn't. It was right on the
He note. Did a good job. And he played. I mean, you know, today they would make the Germans, like, you know, one-dimensional.
Yeah.
And there was just so much characters in that thing. Yeah. You know.
Well, and Preminger, of course.
Yeah. But, yeah. Oh, yeah. He was good, Preminger. And I loved the scene when they all have the Hitler mustaches on.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. A great shot.
Yeah. And so after Starlock 17, then you worked on that other show there with Dick Powell.
Cry Danger, yeah. Yeah. Which was my favorite part.
Yeah. And he was your idol. You really liked
him. Yeah, oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it's
He was a very reserved, great gentleman,
yeah,
a considerate fellow. Yeah. And he said, you know, later on, as I told you, he said, "You've got the best part. Let us know how we can help."
Yeah.
And he helped every bit. You know,
that's great.
I took the picture, but it was the best part.
Yeah. No, that's great when you get these real professionals. And
I've been lucky. I haven't had any real bums since I've been in the business.
Yeah, that's great.
Not really.
Yeah. Today I hear they're nasty. Some of them.
Well, they're young. They're all awfully young, and they have rather short careers, I'm afraid.
That's right.
In the old days, you didn't really come up until you'd been in the theater, and you'd been, you know, it had a lot of experience, and so you could handle it.
Right.
This is awful tough on these young kids because you get instant idolizing.
Right.
And they're they come and they go. It's very sad.
Yeah, it is.
I feel sorry for them.
Yeah. And some of them, like you say, it's too much too soon.
Those are the only misbehaviors I've seen. Kids who believed all that publicity.
You know? Right. 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 So then, around after the 50s, you were coming into television.
Yes.
And, I mean, how many? I read something like 600 shows, TV shows.
I counted. There are 106 feature films and over 600 television shows.
Wow, that's phenomenal. That's a lot of work.
It is a lot of work. And I thought it's not possible I did that many, but I did.
Yeah. I mean, just look on IMDb. It's just...
Matinee theater, I did 12 of those. The Tab Hunter Show, we did 38. Right. And
you work with Nick Adams.
Nick, we did that Saints and Sinners thing.
Yeah,
that's
like 14 episodes or something. Yeah. That's not bad. I mean, it's
too bad that didn't go. I thought that would be that wasn't quite.
Yeah, Nick Adams, he was a good actor. I always liked
Feisty little guy.
Yeah, yeah. And you work with some great guys. Tab Hunter?
Well, I saw Tab last month.
Okay.
He lives up in Montecito.
Oh, all right.
He looks almost exactly the same.
Yeah.
We went to San Francisco last year about this time. They had a film noir festival, and that Cry Danger opened it.
Yeah.
And we were sitting up there waiting to go, and suddenly Tab walked in. He'd come up from Carmel just to be there for it. And what a nice man he is.
Yeah.
What a sweetheart.
Well, you guys get some great memories.
Woo!
Well,
by God, that Tab Hunter show, every week it was the prettiest girl in town.
Yeah.
They all came over because Tab knew every pretty girl in town.
Yeah.
He dated them all, and
plus he was the guy for that time period. Everybody wanted to be Tab Hunter.
Yeah,
and then you worked on the Twilight Zone.
Oh yes,
yeah.
Oh yes,
and you worked on that that one called the Time Clock, stopwatch.
Yeah, a kind of stopwatch.
Which
is apparently a favorite. I get an awful lot of people calling about that.
Oh, that's. As I mentioned on the phone to you, I saw it as a kid, it's an image that stays with you.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, they had a Twilight Zone convention 2 years ago here in out near Warner Brothers, and that was as popular as any of them.
Yeah.
It really was. I was thrilled.
Oh yeah, well you played McNulty and you go into the bank.
Yeah, it was tough to do that.
Yeah.
You know, I had to freeze.
Yeah,
you know, whenever the watch, clicked, and we had to reshoot some of it because if I moved at all, it screwed everything up.
Right,
and it's very difficult to be absolutely still.
That's right,
but we got it. It was a good one.
Yeah, it was a good one. And then plus all the other extras out in the street.
Oh yeah,
and the bars and everything, and it's just to control all that, you know. But it's like when the watch gets damaged, and then you run out. I mean, that's the scene.
That's the end of it, folks.
So I remember
John Rich directed that. Do you know John?
No, I don't know him. No.
Yeah, John, of course, is one of the better comedy directors. And,
yeah.
And John had directed the Ray Bolger show that I did.
Okay.
And, of course, he was all in the family. He directed the first 4 years of it, I think.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Just it's incredible stuff. And then, what was Rod Serling like? What was Rod?
I barely met him. I met him actually not in connection with the Twilight Zone, but there was a raffle, a fundraiser out in Pacific Palisades, and I met him there at that party.
Right.
And we had a nice chat because he had seen the show, the one I did, and a little quiet, very nice person.
He was a great writer.
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
You know, he dictated it all.
Really?
He got up in the morning, had his nice breakfast, and he went out by the swimming pool, and he dictated.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. Dictated to a thing, and then he gave the tape recorder to his secretary, and she typed it up. That's the way he wrote almost everything.
Wow.
So that's amazing.
It's all up in his head.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, today they go through so many drafts.
Oh, yeah. Not him.
Yeah, that's incredible. And then... okay, we talked about your Saints and Sinners with Nick Adams. And,
yeah.
And then in the 70s, you were still working on TV, and then you did Tora, Tora, Tora.
Oh,
you were in that.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
Dickie Fleischer directed that.
Yeah.
And that was actually a pretty good movie.
Yeah.
I'm the guy who started World War II.
That's right.
I didn't pass the message along.
That's right.
I read that script, and I said, you know what I'm doing here? And they said, yeah, you are.
You're the guy.
You're the one. It actually happened. That was true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He didn't go through the right. I think, what did he send it?
He just delayed sending a message. He intercepted. Right. He broke a code.
Right. He broke the code. Yeah.
Yeah. And he just didn't tell him in time.
Yeah.
2 days after Pearl Harbor, he told him.
Wow. That's incredible.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I remember seeing that film in the 70s when it came out.
Yeah.
It was just, the scope of it was just
phenomenal. It's huge.
Yeah.
It was, what, 3 hours long, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And they had, three directors out there. They had two Americans and then one Japanese.
Dickie Fleischer. Yeah, there was a Japanese guy, and I think Andy McLaughlin directed some of it.
Andy McLaughlin, yeah. Vic's kid, yeah.
6 foot six.
Yeah. Did you ever meet the McLaughlin?
Vic McLaughlin? I worked in a movie with him.
Oh, okay. With the father.
Called Sahara. Not Sahara, something like that. It was an RKO. He was one of my favorite actors when I was a kid. And here I am with him, and we're out in the desert, and it's a death scene. It's my death scene.
Right.
And he was an animal. Vic was. Uncontrollable.
Right.
And deer, you know, well-intentioned, but he was an animal.
Yeah.
And here I'm lying in his lap, dying out in the desert, and I die, and I'm in his lap. And he has a big speech. In the course of that speech, he beat the shit out of me with his hat. He's pounding on me. And I have to be dead. I can't move. He apologizes. Oh, I didn't know what you're doing.
He's a big Irish guy. Him and John Wayne, all those guys. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you ever get to meet the Duke at all?
No.
No, never. Never did.
Or Clark Gable.
Oh, wow.
No, not those two I didn't. Cagney, yes. Alan Ladd, yes, but not those two.
Did you ever work on a film with Alan Ladd?
Yeah.
Oh, which film was that?
Called Wild Harvest.
Okay.
And it was about wheat farming, a really boring movie.
Is that the one with the deaf son?
The which?
He had the deaf son.
When no.
The boy was deaf in the movie.
I don't think so.
I don't think that
was. That wasn't Shane, was it?
No, that was not Shane, no.
That's another movie.
Yeah.
No, it was Alan, Robert Preston.
Okay.
Before he split. He left Cry Danger and went directly to New York. He broke his contract, and they were going to sue him. And he said it doesn't matter what they do. And then, of course, he knew what he could do. He went right into Music Man and became a huge Broadway star.
Yeah. And how long were you under contract when you were making? When you did like Star Like 17? Were you under contract with anybody?
Just for the movie.
Just for the movie.
Yeah.
So you were basically a free agent.
Yeah. And, I was only under contract to Warner Brothers.
Warner Brothers. Okay. Yeah. And how do you compare that system to what goes on today? I mean, what do you?
Well, it's so different. Everything, the majors, probably because those old guys who founded the studios had a tendency to think in the long run rather than the short run.
Right.
I'm talking about Mayer and Warner.
Right, right.
And Ginsberg at Paramount and Scuras and the whole batch of them. They planned a lot more carefully. Then things seem nowadays everything is for the moment, it seems to me, and it was a lot easier and a lot more fun, I think.
You want to take a call?
Me? Sure.
Take a call. Hello, you're on with Jack Marino and Richard Urban on LA Talk Radio. This is the mistake I made the last time. Hello.
I'm here.
Okay, I can hear you.
Jack, it's okay. This is Winston.
Hey, Winston, how are you?
I'm doing good. I want to ask him, what was the funniest thing that happened on set? Because, you know, I know the bloopers and, you know, all that. What was the funniest thing that happened?
Oh, what set?
Any set or just any specific?
Oh, it doesn't matter. Oh, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter.
Any set, any shit.
Probably the men. We had a scene where Marlon Brando was in bed, and he was complaining of being thirsty, and they finally gave him some water to drink. They were afraid it would be bad for him. And they took a huge drink of it, and it was gin. That was a reaction, Mr. Brando.
Oh, goodness.
It was pretty funny.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Oh, goodness. That was him. I kept drinking it.
Okay, Winston, I got it because we're up against the clock, so I just want to thank you for calling.
Oh, okay, that's okay.
Thanks for calling, Winston.
All righty. Winston's a radio host in Alabama.
Was that so?
Yeah, he's 17 years old, young kid. And he has his own little network down there.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. All on the internet.
Right.
They're all internet hosts. And, yeah, it's just, you know, I mean, it's, so today, what, you know, you're doing voiceovers today still? Or?
Yeah, I do voiceovers. I'm doing a series, as a matter of fact, at the moment. It's a show called Community, which is resuming. It's starting its second year of the latter part of this month.
Oh, okay, great.
And it's kind of a good show. I'm enjoying it a lot.
Oh, okay. What it was this, any network specifically?
Yeah, it's NBC at 8 o'clock on Thursdays.
Oh, okay.
And it's got a young man named McHale who is an awfully good actor, and I like him very much.
Oh, okay, great.
Jeff McHale,
yeah. And you just finished, there's a film in post-production you just finished. It's a feature film. I think it's, I wrote it down here. The Bag or The Blog?
Oh, yeah. It's just finished.
Yeah.
We shot it up in Medford, Oregon.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it was a very pretty place. And written by an actress and directed by her, produced by her. And it's, she said it worked out very well. It's a rather grim little picture. But I'm looking forward to seeing it.
What do you play in it?
An old guy and his wife, who were in the process of dying.
Oh, wow.
And it's some of it's rather painful. I think it's probably pretty touching. I hope it is.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think it's going to get the theatrical release, or is this going to go?
She's got a release. Yeah.
Oh, good for her.
Yeah.
Good for her.
Yeah, she got that first, which is pretty
simple. Yeah, well, you
kind of have to.
That's the trick, yeah.
They're not going to put up money for pictures that have no release.
That's right.
I know, because I tried to do it years and years and years. I've
been trying to do it myself.
You know.
When you directed the Brothers O'Toole, that was your first time directing. What was that experience?
That was the second time, actually.
Oh, second time?
I directed a movie which I wrote and produced called Bleep.
Oh, okay.
And it was just a small budget picture, but I directed that too. Brothers O'Toole?
Yeah.
A joy.
Yeah.
We shot that up in Colorado. I'd lived in Colorado, and a man named Charles Cellier came down and put the package together and did a very good job of it, I think. I think I mistreated Mr. Cellier, but he got it together. And with John Astin, who was a wonderful comedian, and a bunch of character actors, Pat Carroll and Jesse White and Alan Jocelyn, and what a good company.
Right, great.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Actors I had loved, and I've hired every one of them.
Oh, great. That's
Hans Conried.
Oh, he was
wild man.
Yeah, he was fantastic.
He came down, he was doing a theater thing in Denver.
Right.
And I called him up, and I said, Hans, can you come down here to Canyon City? I've got a part for you. I said, I just need you for one day.
Yeah.
And he came down, he showed up, tall and forbidden. And I said, Hans, there's no way in the world you can overplay this part. And he said, my boy, you'll resent that till the day you die. And he played huge, and it was right on the nose.
Yeah. One of the best roles I liked him in was when he played with Gregory Peck on Anthony Quinn, The World in His Arms. And he was the hotel manager.
That's right.
Yeah, he was good in that.
Yes, he's a damn good actor.
He was, yeah, yeah. And so what's on besides this show you're doing?
Oh, I've written a book, which I'm hoping looks like it's going to get published.
Yeah.
Called Standing in the Mud, Staring at the Stars.
Oh, that's great. That's a good title. I like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I write a lot and enjoy myself. My wife and I cook and drink and have a good time.
Oh, that's good for you. Good for you, Richard. It's very good. You know, there's other shows here that deal with motion pictures, like at TJ in the Morning.
Yeah.
TJ McCormick Show.
Yeah.
And if you want to get on his show, I can make, you know, I can talk to TJ. And sure. Then on Sunday, there's a guy and gal here, David and Karen. They have a show called Film Courage.
Really?
They talk about films and stuff like that.
I
kind of deal with independent filmmaking and also old Hollywood, which I love, you know.
Yeah.
So
I
had a fellow in here, Steve Hayes, who lived with Errol Flynn in 1949.
Really?
Yeah, he traveled with them and everything. Yeah, he's just some great stories. So I like the old stuff, you know.
Well, Flynn, as I started to say, was such a gentleman, to my knowledge. He was very, very nice to me. And the girls followed. They were everywhere. He had two guys who watched out for him.
Yeah.
Jim Fleming and Buster Wiles.
Oh, but I've met Buster.
Yeah.
When Buster wrote his book, I got to meet him.
Yeah. And they were around all the time, keeping the girls away and keeping them available, too. And,
that's right. Well, Buster plays a small role in The Plane.
Is that so?
When he said, he's the guy that says, if you're going to do something, and do it in a bucket.
Yeah.
You know?
That's great.
Yeah, so Buster had a few roles in his films, you know.
Well, he was Flynn's attendant.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's... well, this was great. You know, the show's about winding down, and it was great having you here.
Oh, it's a kick. Thank
and,
you.
And we'll have to do it again. We'll talk some more.
You betcha.
Yeah, and again, I'll let you, you know, I'll give you those names for the other shows.
Great, thank you.
And you want to promote your book and anything, you know.
Great.
Because internet radio is growing.
Is it?
Yeah, so you can
That's
reach
good.
A lot of fans. And
you bet.
You have a website?
Yeah, sure.
What's the name of the website?
Dix Hardy.
Dix Hardy.
Yeah, H-A-R-D-Y at... scmglobal.net.
Okay, global.net.
Yeah.
And all right, well, then we'll put that out there and
get people. I can never remember it.
Yeah. Well, Dick, thank you for coming. I really appreciate
you. Thank you, Jack.
We had a lot of
fun.
All right.
Yeah.
You're listening to Jack Marino, Warrior Filmmaker, right here on LA Talk Radio.